All right, everyone. Welcome back to episode 18 of Christian History and Ideas. I'm John Coleman, and I'm joining today Dr. Nirmal Das. How are you, Dr. Das?
Fine, thanks, John. Great to be here. Always a pleasure.
We're talking about relics. This is our topic, and one episode leads into another in the way that conversation always does. And lately, we've been talking about pilgrimage and the concept as it developed in the early church. And so that physical activity brought up this one, and that is relics, the relics of saints and of significant figures from the Bible, well, in a sense, pilgrimage itself is a visit to larger relics that cannot be transported. So we're looking at all this, and in our 17th episode, which you viewers are recommended to watch before this one, we talked about this idea and the incarnational aspect of Christianity and how the belief in relics was dulled in the 18th and 19th and 20th and 21st centuries. Yes, because of malice perhaps on the part of some, but also just perhaps an inappropriate approach to data points and so forth. I'm just speaking for myself. I think that there's a tendency just to automatically go to malicious will. And sometimes when we see this phenomena, the skepticism put on saint stories or relics, we knee-jerk react and say, these people hate the saints. Well, it could just be that they're making an error of epistemology and about these sorts of things. And that's what we were getting into, and we left with a very appropriate reference for this year of grace 2020, as Dr. Das was talking about Plato's cave and relics as a antidote to that. So before we reprise our topic proper in this 18th episode, we'll begin with some words here from sacred scripture, and this is from the first book of Kings and the 15th chapter. And we're looking at, help me out here, Dr. Das. What are we looking at? I know the story, but do you have the citation with you?
We're on 2 Kings, chapter 13.
13, oh, okay. That wind blew over
Second
the
Kings,
old.
2 Kings, chapter 13, verses 20. Onwards.
2 Kings 13, 20. You're getting closer and we're good. Okay.
Good.
But whilst they were sitting at table, the word of the Lord came to the prophet who had brought him back, and he cried out to the man from Judah, "Thus says the Lord." Is this the one that we want?
Are you in 2 Kings or 1 Kings?
There we go.
But we need 2 Kings.
2 Kings 13. There we go.
Yeah.
And this is teleprompter free, like they say. Okay, there we go. Promise. The third time's a charm. Okay, it's okay. For the whole eternity. 2 Kings 13, verse 20. I see it here. And so Elisha died and was buried. At that time of the year, the bands of Moabites used to raid the land. Once some people were burying a man, when suddenly they saw such a raiding band. So they cast the man into the grave of Elisha, and everyone went off. But when the man came in contact with the bones of Elisha, he came back to life and got to his feet. Very good. So we're looking at relics, and we have a fine scriptural kickoff there from 2 Kings, chapter 13, verses 20 and 21.
Right, yeah. And this helps us understand, as you pointed out, and I think this is something we need to highlight and stress, the sacramental point of what a relic is and what it does. And it also points us back to what we were discussing in our previous discussion, this idea that relics are the location of where God enacts miracles, or God enacts something incredulous that is beyond our understanding in reality, and that therefore relics help us understand what divinity or what the divine, what God is all about, and what Gregory of Tours referred to as paradise, i.e. what redemption is all about. So in that passage you read in Elisha's bones, touching the dead man and the dead man coming back to life, of course we know what that implies. This is the entire cycle of resurrection, of us dying and then us being reborn and then resurrecting, just like Christ. So this idea then of relics is far more than simply, as we looked at in the last episode, as some relic of paganism that has crept into and corrupted Christianity. What we're really talking about is actually the very foundation of what Christianity is all about, i.e. how is it that we become resurrected? How is it that we become redeemed? And I think that's a very important dynamic in the context of relics that we should keep in mind.
And Dr. Das, as we reprise our conversation here, one of the topics which came up to me as we were talking about the errors of interpretation in the 18th and 19th century, and then almost an insult to those writers of error, is how what we in the modern era have done, and we've quite distorted even their bad conclusions. And so you get things like we've discussed before, like Zeitgeist and so forth, where there's a total apostasy and so forth during the 4th and 5th centuries. And whatnot. And some of this goes back to discourse from the Reformation as well. But it's really, just get clunkier and clunkier as we kick it one generation to the next. And that brought my mind to thinking if we could discuss not the validity of that idea, but the idea that once Christianity, particularly in the West, is no longer under explicit persecution and has an increasingly definite theology and an institutional structure which is stabilizing and whatnot throughout the 3rd, 4th, 5th centuries, can we speak of not this paganization of Christianity, but is there a dynamic of, shall we say, relaxation happening?
And that's a great term. Great term. Certainly. What happens very quickly, let's set the historical context very quickly. What Christianity does when it enters the Roman world as alternative faith to what Roman paganism was all about, what it does is that it actively relaxes all the various prohibitions and laws which governed pagan religion or pagan belief. and these were very extensive, from what you do when you get up throughout your day, et cetera, and what you do before you go to bed. All of those things were covered by various prohibitions, regulations, laws, and whatnot. And of course, this was the same situation in the Hebrew faith system. There are so many, halakhic laws, 640 of them or something like that. Anyway, the point is that there was all of human life was governed by, both in the pagan and the Jewish context, were governed by regulations and prohibitions and rules. What Christianity does is that it comes and, well, relaxation would be an understatement in this context. It basically blows up the whole concept of prohibition. That religion is no longer about prohibitions and what you can and cannot do. Religion is about love. It's a very dynamic and explosive concept in the Roman faith systems that existed in the Roman world. including the Jewish. So what it does then, undermines this whole idea of prohibition, which governed the logic of all faiths at this time. And this relaxation, I think, is an important concept to, and you've, I think, you know, described it perfectly. This relaxation of prohibition engenders a lot of anger against Christianity in the Roman world. And this, of course, anger gets expressed in very famously in the persecutions and whatnot. But there's also an anger about something more profound for the Roman mind, the pagan Roman mind, which is that if we get rid of prohibitions that these Christians are demanding we get rid of or not observing, if we get rid of these prohibitions, what happens to Rome? What happens to us as Romans? Are we still Romans anymore? Because Romans are determined and defined by those prohibitions and rules and regulations and laws, which are steeped in what we would now refer to as religion or religiosity. Everything about life is religion. There is no life outside of it because everything is included in those parameters of legalities and prohibitions. So when Christianity says, well, we don't need any of that, you know, let's just talk about love and getting along with each other and be, you know, good human beings and look at, worry about our redemption, all of those other things. This is a very different and completely new kind of vocabulary being brought into the human mind at this time, a vocabulary that doesn't exist at all. And so what it's doing is it's overriding the default system of the Roman world with something very different. And that difference is what makes people very upset and very angry. You know, there's a lot of Roman writers at this time who rail and rant against Christianity about how bad it is. And of course, rules are brought in and Christianity is made illegal. Imposes the capital punishment on it, death penalty and all that sort of thing. And the question we have to ask is why? But as you've pointed out, it's this relaxation of prohibitions that Christianity brings in. And this relaxation includes practices. For example, until the 6th century, the Romans still practice Lupercalia, you know, where you know, the youths would run around naked into the city you know, to usher in the new year and all that sort of thing. But the point was that
I should interject that there was a saint in the day that we're recording this in the martyrology who was executed because he would not take part in the Lupercalia. Right. I think it might have been Saturnalia, which was a similar family, not friendly event.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. So these become cultural customs. Let's put it that way. It's like Christians allowing certain cultures, the Roman culture, to exist. So that difference between culture and religion is now going to be established. So the Lupercalia would be something that the Romans do that. Isn't that nice? Let's go have a look at it. It has nothing, or it doesn't affect the faith at all. So suddenly you have this bifurcation of reality. You have something that you do for fun or something like that, or culture or something like that, but it has nothing to do with what reality of faith and life is all about. And it's this breakage, this split of reality from religion and the prohibitions of religion that Christianity brings about. And this will lead to charges of paganism and all that sort of thing, because this relaxation will suggest to people only later that Christians are now into this adopting the paganism mode of saying, oh, well, we don't have a bit of that, so why don't we bring that in from ancient Roman belief? Or we don't have anything about that, so let's bring that in. That's not exactly what's going on here, because nowhere is there any evidence of this happening anytime, anywhere in Christianity. The essential character of the faith is never tampered with by anybody. But what happens is that Christians are no longer nasty about their faith in that regard, in this context, i.e. they permit certain things to exist because it doesn't really contradict what they believe, i.e. the world can do what it likes. You can have fun with the world and enjoy it, but you have to know your own reality as well. So it's a very different kind of mindset being created. Getting back to our topic, the point of relics is exactly that. It's a counter narrative, let's put it this way, to the Roman narrative. The relic narrative is extremely and totally counter to what the Romans have been going on about forever, and the Hellenistic world, I should say, has been going on forever about what death and mortality is all about. Death is the final defeat of human beings in the Roman world, in the Hellenistic world. This is where all of the philosophies, all of the reason, all of that stuff is totally destroyed when it comes face to face with death. This is why, for example, the Greek, Greek philosophy has these two key concepts juxtaposed with each other. Eros kaithanatos, love and death are juxtaposed, where love is, supposed to engender more human beings and death gets rid of them. And this is that something they can never reconcile. But Christianity, through relics, justifies and explains that conflict. How do you resolve this conflict of love and death? Well, you do it through this idea of the relic. What do you mean? Well, what is a relic? A relic is someone who has achieved what life is all about, i.e. salvation, and has left a bit of his achievement behind for us to look at and contemplate and examine and perhaps participate through the grace of God in miracles. And by doing so, we then become part and parcel of his experience of what he has gone through. So death is not a tragic defeat of humanity. Death is simply a process. So there's nothing unholy, nothing polluting about the dead body. And this is why I think intentionally shrines are included inside the city. The Roman world always excluded the dead from the city. You could not have the dead inside the city. You had to get rid of them within a few hours, really, i.e. through cremation and all that. But here, the Christians are building shrines around dead bodies. They're building churches. They worship with them. I mean, they're buried in the sanctuary and all this sort of thing. Totally un-Roman. So what they're also getting rid of is this very deeply ingrained idea in the Hellenistic world of the defeat of life, the defeat of the body, that concept of thanatos, death, that was very prevalent in the Roman world. And that is the other form of relaxation in which the relics participate, aside from, getting rid of the laws and the prohibitions.
And of course, this discussion of relaxation, just to put this into context, of course, runs directly and is a direct consequence of the conclusions of grace. I mean, that's what this is all in a response to. If you understand the concept of grace and so forth, that's where one understands dynamic of relaxation. And I think this idea of the paganization of Christianity as it's presented, I'm getting the image or the simile for something that I do after all of these shows, which is to use a program on Windows called Paint. All right. And I think a dynamic that we're seeing with this is we have this nuanced understanding of the situation of the church in the late classical or early medieval period. And just like you do with paint, if you just impose an image there the image is as it is. But if you compress that image, if you compress the pixels and you make it smaller, the picture gets increasingly distorted. And I think there's a dynamic that if people understand the full scope of history, the dynamics, the theology at play, and this sort of thing, and they see the picture as it is, there's this relaxation concept we can understand. Where we're seeing these problems is, I argue, that we're seeing the image as it is, increasingly compressed and sound-bitized. And this is how we end up with our favorite reference here, which is the Dagon head, obviously, is the bishop's hat.
Exactly, yes, exactly. And that's exactly what's going on. You know, I think you've explained it perfectly. That's exactly the dynamic at play here. And this dynamic has engendered all its own kind of reality, or it's established its own kind of reality, which is, you know, enabling more distortions to take place. You know, what we're really looking at is that Christianity allows for the relaxations of prohibitions and frees up the mind, basically, from all of those hurdles that it was enclosed in. And by freeing up the mind, it offers the mind, you know, various other ways of explaining reality. But one of the things, of course, that is also important that we have to keep in mind is that as we look at this idea of relics in early Christianity and, of course, modern, what we're also looking at is this idea that reality itself is not entirely absent of the divine, i.e. Christ's incarnation is not a one-off event in that regard, i.e. he doesn't come and then disappear forever. There's something about it that is repeatable, accessible, and something that is therefore faith-inducing. In all of the pagan stories, whenever gods interact with with humans, they come and go. You know, and when they go, there's always disaster that follows. It's never really a good event. So whenever the gods show up, it's you better keep your eyes out. You know, because something's going to be really bad. When the bad's going to happen, something really bad's going to happen when they leave. In the Christian context, when the incarnation happens and the ascension happens, or when in that context deity goes back to being divine, it's not a disaster. It's not some kind of a horrible event that now we have to deal with. So the interaction or the coming together of something holy and something human is not a source of chaos and disaster. It's not a source of destruction, because that's what often happens. The human is destroyed somehow when it comes in contact with the divine in the Hellenistic world, in the pagan world. In the Christian world, when humanity comes in contact with the divine, it is saved, it's salvation. That's a very different concept, you know, from the Roman worldview. And what better way to explain that process than to have a relic which allows human beings to access, experience, understand this dynamic of or interaction with the divine, where an ordinary human being, through a relic, can touch, can look at, can understand, and can examine that which is divine. So accessibility to divinity then is another very important, I think, aspect of relics, is that it makes the divine immediately knowable, accessible, and therefore more human in a way, for lack of a better term. And this, I think this dynamic then of what relics do help us understand how rapidly the Roman world is changing because of Christianity, what Christianity does to the Roman world. And therefore, the area of pagan influence is hardly existent. Like, which aspect of Christianity can we say is pagan? And that question, of course, no one can really answer, because there isn't really one. Yes, you can point to, you can, you know, using Hume, you can say all kinds of things about, make assumptions and say all kinds of things. But it's very difficult to say this part of Christianity is purely pagan, this part is purely Christian. And the two got mixed up in some other, you know, some place. And we have the result of, you know, corrupted Christianity, which then needed to be, you know, purified later on, like the Reformation or Hume and all these people that they do. So this dynamic of the relic then is, I think, very important as well, that the relic is not a dead thing. It's a dynamic thing. It's something that bridges to realities. And in a very, I guess, moving way, it answers or solves the very old Hellenistic riddle of love and death, eros and thanatos. How do you solve the two? The Greeks and the Romans could not. Christians do. And I think the relic is an expression of that solving, of that solution that the Christians have you know, brought to the world.
I'd like now to read a quote from a book which has provided us with some direction here and some points to talk about, and that is Charles Freeman's Holy Bones, Holy Dust. And, you know, we talk about the conflict between the Christians and the reigning culture, including the state. And this is a quote from chapter 2 or 3 from there, somewhat lengthy, but I think it's a good pivot point here. So this is the change in the perception of the dead from the classical world, and not just the dead, but as Dr. Das pointed out, death itself as a dynamic. So it talks about St. Ambrose, who had a role actually at one point in his life in the Roman administration. He was governor of Gaul before God got to him. So here's the quote. Ambrose was treading on dangerous ground. It talks about Ambrose finding some bones, some relics, and then using them in the cathedral, and this being a development of the concept. In the same year, Theodosius issued a law forbidding corpses to be brought within burial within the city walls. Dead flesh was disgusting and dangerous. The risk of contamination had always been recognized, and Theodosius was doing no more than reaffirming the custom and good sense. As the scoffing of Ambrose shows, that is, Ambrose receiving scoffing for his claims, the use of body parts to effect miracles went deeply against the traditions and instincts of Greek and Roman society. The philosophers had long taught that the appetites and desires of the living body subverted the efficaciousness of rational thought and contemplation. The uses of bodies as a medium through which miracles could be achieved was beyond comprehension to anyone with an educated mind. Christianity overcame these inhibitions through a development of an idea that was unique to it. There had been an original state of a spiritual flesh that had been lost in the fall of Adam and Eve from paradise. So, Dr. Das, let's take our discussion into the role of relics and this appreciation, the sensitivity to physicality and sanctity, and put it within the discussions that we've had and that are related to this that we have not had, such as the rise of the pilgrimage and this this category of things.
Yes. What we're really looking at is this...
including as the author points out, the retooling of the idea of one's birthday into one's day into heaven. This is, I think, part of this thrust.
Sure, yes. So what we're really looking at is this idea or the birth of this concept of the shrine, what a shrine is, and also the birth of this concept of what a saint is. Now, you know, the Greeks and the Romans, the Hellenistic world did not, they had shrines, they had all these sort of things, but none of those shrines or none of the shrines, I should say, were involved with human beings as such. They were simply shrines where God somehow did something. But in the Christian context, shrines are always about saints who have achieved redemption through good works and through faith, etc. And they become therefore, part and parcel of this parcel of redemption that people can unpack for themselves by visiting the shrine, by through prayer and faith and all that sort of thing. And when this parcel is delivered within the context of the shrine, the church, or wherever this, it could be, a grotto or whatever, what happens is that human beings, individual human beings, are no longer excluded. It's rather a very particularist kind of delivery of holiness. It's delivery to each and every individual who goes and touches the relic, venerates the relic, and so forth. And this individual, for lack of a better term, blessing, is something that is that involves the faith in ways of looking at the world that is very distinct from what had existed before, i.e., in the Hellenistic world, when we're talking about individuals, well, there was no concept of individual redemption. What we're really looking at is, again, in the context of death and all that sort of thing, what we're really looking at is simply ways of understanding how to live a good life here and now. This idea of the good life as a preparation for something more real than what it is right now is a very, very strange concept for the Hellenistic world. Because as we looked at earlier, the death is the final defeat of humanity in the Hellenistic world. After death, death is the final answer that no philosopher can explain. The only way to do it is don't worry about it too much, live a good life, be happy, pursue pleasure, and all these sorts of answers like the various philosophers give. But there is no answer to this concept of what death is. And it's only with Christianity that this answer begins to be elaborated, and elaborated really fully. So the shrine then becomes a very dynamic place where the answer to death is given. So you say this person, that there is salvation after death. Well, how do I know that? Well, let's go to this shrine and let's look at the life of this person, this holy person, and see what happened. And let's look at what the benefits of going to this shrine are. Well, there are various interactions with divinity. How do I know that? Well, there are miracles. So it becomes, like I said, a parcel that is delivered, to an individual, the shrine. And this parcel carries with it, when you unwrap it, all these various elements that are completely new in the Roman context. And this newness, this further elaboration of what life is all about, I think allows Christianity to become dominant, not simply as a faith system, but as a way to understand what life is all about, i.e. how to live a good life acquires a new meaning. It's no longer the Greek philosopher's answer to how to not worry about thanatos, death, but it's the good life that is filled with holiness. And we've looked at that concept earlier. So I would look at the shrine as a very contained parcel set within the city, not outside of it, as you read in your quotation. And interestingly enough, it's about at the same time, just as an analogous sort of development, you also have the development of monasteries. And what is a monastery? Well, it's the city in the desert, which is, again, desert is a place to be avoided because it's a place that is, where the gods have somehow chosen not to make habitation possible. So again, the Christian mind is upturning Hellenistic logic pagan logic and saying, well, wait a minute, what do you mean I can't go and live in the desert? And this this upturning again is that process of reestablishing or relaxing the various prohibitions that it governed, what reality is. So suddenly, through all these various means, reality is acquiring greater or even fuller meaning than it had before. And I think that is one of the, you know, aside from all the faith stuff that we can get into, that we have been getting into, there's also this realignment of understanding of what reality is all about.
Yes, and as you lay that out, it's interesting that, and this is an area also where modern Western Christianity, both its Protestant and Catholic, given the robust history, I sometimes feel to say pretenders, we're so far removed from these things, but I just speak corporately, not individually, of course. But in any case, modern Western Christianity, whatever, however you take it, this is an area where I think we've also lost completely. Most religion at this point is completely ethereal, and it's also assumed are completely in for heaven. There's that idea that you had in the early church and in the medieval world, of a sense of to use the Orthodox or the Eastern Catholics also use this, that the idea of theosis, that heaven's coming to earth as well. I think we see that, hashed out in the idea of relics themselves. Their idea, one is that, yes, there's this greater reality coming that you pointed out, but also that this life itself is sublimated and sanctified and lifted up in a sense to heaven as well. And that dynamic, I think we've lost in the modern West.
Completely, I think we've completely
lost. And I'm seeing, you know, even us people who flatter ourselves thinking we're holy rollers and we got everything in order, we've lost a lot of this.
We have, because we still live by the logic of Hume. That has not, you know, we haven't escaped it. We're still in the cave. And therefore, I think you've hit it on the head. This idea of theosis, which I think we should, you know, touch upon here, and maybe we can discuss later on. This idea of theosis is very, very, so very important. Did you want to briefly explain what that is, just for people to know?
In the index cards that I use when I'm exercising, my definition for theosis is divinization via grace, or that's the one that I recall off the cuff, but it's this idea that I even, and this isn't limited, by the way, to Eastern theology. Augustine has a quote that's quoted in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which, if it's taken literally in our very clunky modern way of reading, can lead to all sorts of errors where, you know, we're basically to the effect that we are becoming gods. And he's touching on this early church reality of theosis, but he doesn't mean it in like a Mormon sense or in this sense. But the idea that as grace fills our soul, we're drawn deeper and deeper into the reality of God.
Very, you know, quickly, theosis is becoming Christ-like. You know, very quick, definition. That's the one I use. It's like how you become Christ-like. Theosis is God, you know, filling. But you're right. It isn't becoming God. that's not what the point here is. But it's becoming Christ-like, and therefore these relics are of those people that became Christ-like.
And I suggest that the suffix osis, right? I mean, this is I don't have the dictionaries with me, but this is almost like it implies a process happening, the osis, like osmosis in natural science. It's like an ongoing deepening.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. And it's a condition of being. Let's put it that way. It's a condition of being. It's how we are going to be living our lives throughout on the planet Earth. How are we going to live it? Are we going to be trying to be as Christ-like as possible, you know, doing our very best to be Christ-like, or is it going to be some other way? And as you've rightly pointed out, we've completely in all aspects of Christianity, completely lost this process of theosis. We no longer understand it. We no longer know it. We no longer acknowledge it, let alone be guided by it. And that is, I think, one of the rather tragic events of modernity.
I wonder if this isn't analogous to the Western concept of the state of grace.
Yes.
But the state of grace, this is just the decomposition of our situation. I think, you know, at the point in the 21st century that we're at, I think a lot of us have to really reevaluate, a lot of things. So even that concept of the state of grace is almost bound up with a certain legalistic understanding that loses the deeper profundity of theosis. I submit that concept of the state of grace probably had a much more dynamic understanding than a very just kind of legalistic thing has turned into.
Well, it is. I mean, the prime example of grace is the Annunciation to the Virgin Mary. What is it that grace is? It's transformative. It's redemptive, and so forth. Among the various things we've lost in our cave. As we've entered the cave, I should say, is this concept of what our belief really is, our faith really is. We only have a shadow of that faith often. And unfortunately, it's a process. I'm sure we'll come out of the cave as well eventually. We have to. But what has happened in the meantime is that we have become so inundated by the shadows, or rather by so entertained, might be a better way of putting it, so entertained by the shadows that we no longer understand the reality of what it is that we're looking at, or why we are doing what we do, i.e. we've become observers of screens, and there you have it. We sit around and observe screens all day long, and now in our pandemic age, those screens are, of course, even more predominant than ever before. We are all determined by watching something on a screen. So it's all interaction. So this hyper observation mode, we're always observing. We're always made to look and regard rather than participate. That, I think, is the problem here in the end. And this is what has defeated a true understanding of theosis in our age. Because theosis contradicts all of that, contradicts the passive sitting around watching something play out on a screen or on a cave. That, I think, is what we need to get beyond and get past. And we can only do this when we have a clearer, a better understanding, or I should say a clearer understanding of what it is to be, a Christian in the 21st century. It's no longer, as you point out, it should no longer be an intellectual activity, which it has become,
Excellent. Dr. Doss, as we come to the end of this episode 18, impressed that these changes we see in the early church after the early fourth century, very often it's this relaxation. It's also taking certain scriptural concepts and latent concepts and having the freedom to manifest them. One of the ones that sticks with me as we come to a conclusion here is the idea of relics. And you mentioned very interestingly, this comparison between the ancient mythos of God's coming and then leaving, and I'm impressed. And in the context of relics, and then in the context of a very denuded and increasingly lonely West, the hope that's held out in the verse, "I've not left you orphans," and in a sense, relics properly understood as transmitters of grace or echoes of grace, they're a reminder of that we've not been left as orphans.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And the God we believe in is not the Roman gods. It is not part of that dynamic. It's a very different dynamic that we believe in. It's interactive. And, you know, interestingly enough, very quickly before we finish, this idea of Plato reminds me that Plato's cave, that image, is a perfect description of Roman paganism as well, of all paganism. Paganism completely, in its essence, is that. So Plato summarizes, aside from all the other stuff, summarizes the faith that he lives, that he inhabits.
Yes, a lot of people don't realize this. You know, just like they say with George Orwell or with Aldous Huxley, oh, they're warning us. No, they're not. They're telling you the program. And Plato's the same thing. If you actually read the allegory of the cave, he's not warning you. He actually goes on the next paragraph to say, no, we have to keep doing this to people.
Exactly.
And, you know, everything comes full circle. You know, it's interesting, in the Enlightenment, one of the improvements of the Enlightenment, or one of the policies, was to bury outside the city. We're back to where we started. That, you know, you think back to, if you read Les Mis, that's a, like, kind of a plot point there. We talk, everything's coming full circle. I just did a presentation elsewhere on, you know, Emmanuel Macron a couple of years ago give a whole speech how he's Jupiter and he has the powers of Jupiter. And we're back to the understanding of death. I've had this happen, you know, lately with someone I know, and, you know, here today, gone tomorrow, cremated and moving on. And nobody, there's no consideration of death and the profundity. And I'll tell you, I know morticians. I've interviewed morticians on my other channel. And Carrie Northey, and you can go check out her stuff. She'll tell you this. There are closets in every funeral home. There are closets that have the cremated remains in them because the family's just forgotten. And they put the, you know, they don't want to pay for it. They don't want to pick it up. And this is where we're at with our understanding of death. This is, and everything else is back full circle. And this is the last point I'll make is, in education, you know, you go to these so-called Ivy League schools, all the bankers' kids and lawyers' kids, all they study is Plato and the humanities and things, and they're right. Studying this stuff, and we have that world, and here we are.
Yeah, exactly. We're back into that Hellenistic world. You're right. Yeah. You hit it on the head. That's a great way to summarize what we've just been talking about.
But as we wind things up and we direct you to like and subscribe and write us at Christian History and Ideas, we do conclude, and I suspect our conversations will go in this direction in the months ahead. This is God's great reset right now. This is not Anthony Fauci's great reset. This isn't Bill Gates's. This is Klaus Schwab's great reset. This is God's great reset, if we'll be the hands and feet of God. So we'll see who's laughing last in this thing.
That's it. Yes, that is so true.
So Dr. Doss, tell us about the Postol and some good read and material we can have.
Great. So our December issue is coming up, which I know I would also encourage people to look at the November one. It's very interesting. But the December issue is coming up, in which you have some very interesting interviews. There's one interview, very interestingly, with Guggenheim, the French scholar, in which he responds to this article in The Guardian, which says that, you know, the Notre Dame in Paris is an Eastern understanding of culture and all this sort of thing. It's a very silly concept. So it's a very interesting refutation, unpacking of all of that kind of understanding, where the Christian model is always denied and it's given another meaning, which is non-Christian. And that is that dynamic. And it's, you know, why this is happening is because, of course, the Notre Dame has been burned, as we all know, to the ground, literally. And is now being considered how to be rebuilt. And there's all kinds of, suggestions as bizarre as, you know, making a swimming pool there and et cetera. So it's coming in that context. So The Guardian, being what it is in England, it's a newspaper, is saying, suggesting, well, you know, it wasn't all that great. It was stolen from the East, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's going to be a very interesting article for people to take a look at when it comes out in December.
Excellent. As relating opakustastasis, I would simply direct, as the spring 2021 semester is nigh, to go to opakustastasisinstitute.wordpress.com, and you can see the full courses of the school for 3 years, if that's your bailiwick, or I suppose, the once-off classes, Latin 1, 2, 3, Introduction to Historiography, Introduction to Pedagogy, Rome 1 and 2, semester apiece, Introduction to Dante, and then Dante proper. So there's a lot going on, and please check that out. And also write us regarding this series. Please write us at christianhistoryandideas@gmail.com. And also you'll find various references, including to the Apostle and Opakustastasis, as well as the book Holy Bones, Holy Dust, which we've taken some quotes from. All of that stuff will be down below here on BitChute and on YouTube. So with that, viewers, thank you for watching, and thank you so much, Dr. Dost, for your fine insights.
Thank you, John. It's always a pleasure to be here. Great to talk to you.